This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcasts at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark here. I am joined here with Ross Calvin, and we're going to be discussing his proposal for a Prometheus statue with Jason Rezaj or Johnny on Alcatraz Island in San Francisco. Ross, it's great speaking with you.
Thanks, Robert. Thanks for having me. It's very nice to talk to you. I'm sorry to say I might issue one correction already. Dr. Giorgiani hasn't been able to be a part of the project here for a few months, lamentably. And so he's not on any longer. He had a few things to attend to personally. And incidentally, as we get started here, he's a very brilliant man, as I think most people know. And yet he's also not really a real estate developer. And there's a sense in which this is sort of a real estate development, just a big one. And so there were some ways in which it wasn't quite the best fit, actually, either. Nonetheless, I respect him a great deal, and it's been somewhat of a shame that that's developed the way that it has. However, things are progressing afoot, and I'd love to share more about it.
Before we get to discuss the project, do you want to give a brief introduction to yourself? About
sure.
Yourself?
Yeah. Well, I grew up in New Mexico in the Southwest, and I've been a finance guy most of my life. I ran an investment fund, an Austrian economics-focused strategies, global macro and frontier markets and volatility for about 10 years. And then 3.5 years ago, just under, I transitioned to being a Bitcoin miner. So we've had some operations in different parts of the world going on these now 3 years, 2.5 years. And I developed a blockchain platform for oil and gas right in the middle of that fund strategy, which was anchored around Bitcoin. And it was the best performing sort of pool of assets in the strategy. And so, as it got to be quite a stressful, 10 years will take a toll. So it got to be somewhat stressful, and I took the best ideas and the best sort of distillation of our practice and folded that into the mining company that I run. So anyway, I mean, there's a very nice tie-in between the mythos of Prometheus and sound money. Yeah, no, and it's that, if you imagine that, and this is what I was hoping to share with you this evening, it's that if you imagine that the Prometheus figure represents sort of the basic and most profound agency of man, then you come to understand that, his forward-looking attributes, that's what Prometheus means, obviously, can't really be facilitated in a modern economy without sound money. Basically it changes our time preference such that we can focus on things that are further out in the future as opposed to being reactive. And so anyway, there's a very nice economic sort of fundamentals tie-in between sound money as a la Bitcoin and the Promethean mythos.
So the project is called American Colossus, and it's to build a Prometheus statue on Alcatraz. Was this initially your idea or Jason Georgiani's idea? Do you want to kind of give an introduction to how you thought up with this and the significance of Prometheus, sort of how he ties in with America's spirit of innovation and of techne?
Well, it was mine. I actually floated it. It sort of circulated it about right before the election, the Biden-Trump election. And it sort of the first time it occurred to me, actually, or at least building a statue on Alcatraz occurred to me when I was 5 or 6 years old. We were sailing, and well, no, it must have been when I was about 10. Anyway, sailing past Alcatraz in the bay, and I looked at it and I saw, well, gosh, what a crazy thing to have this kind of bummed out kind of insignificant thing on this island, and it's a perfect place for a symbol of triumph and beauty and nobility and freedom and the power of technology to liberate humankind, really. And so I think even all the way back then, and I was visiting, I think in 2018, some friends, and we had this very beautiful night across the bay in Alameda, and we were coming back in the sunset, and the light was hitting it just right, and we decided that this was going to be something that we'd have to accomplish in our generation. So however, my first inclination was frankly a bit kitschy, I admit, which was that a Statue of Liberty, which rhymed with the one in New York City, would be very appropriate. But I discovered Jason's work, gosh, maybe around that time. I can't remember quite when it was. The funny thing about it was that he used to appear on a show that was run out of sort of a house that was really close to where I grew up, in Albuquerque. And it was this,
What is this new thinking allowed?
So
I
Jeffrey.
interviewed Jeffrey Mishlove back, like, I forget when it was, maybe it was like 2017.
Well, yeah. So you probably know that there's this sort of strange subculture in the Southwest. There's sort of, broadly speaking, like
Oh
kind of
yeah,
like
and
Sedona.
I was in Sedona over 4th of July weekend.
Yeah, exactly. So it's
I saw a bookstore in Sedona that had like a lot of interesting books on like mysticism, like that really fit in with the kinds of, I think like Jason's books would be perfect there, but they didn't have them, but like it really fits in perfectly with like the kind of stuff they talk about in Thinking Aloud.
Yeah, no, and it was a sort of a normal thing, growing up in that part of the country, and strangely abnormal for most of the rest of the world, I guess. And so, I mean, strange to me, but it was on PBS, and I never watched anything else. And so, he appeared on there, and I just kind of started tuning in a little bit, anyway. And I found it very moving because his ability to reach back into the deep annals of religious history and synthesize quite archaic and kind of arcane things for daily and modern relevance was very powerful. And the reason it resonated with me was really that in this fund strategy and in my world as an entrepreneur, we kind of have this familiarity or friendliness to Promethean style sort of disposition anyway. And it seemed very natural. And it was wonderful to hear the sort of codified that people had codified this way of being and thinking so very long ago. And that's not something that we get to learn very much about in school. We have to really seek it out independently. And so, Dr. Georgiani was, among many other things, wonderful about that. And so, as this, there was a sense in which, I I'm a big fan of Howard Rourke, who's the Ayn Rand hero, and there's a sense in which this sort of totem always was the most resonant with me. And so, after thinking about what really belongs on that island, and what really resonates most meaningfully and most necessarily with this moment in time, this moment in the West, and this moment in San Francisco, and this moment in our country, the Prometheus is, let's say, a no-brainer.
So this would also be sort of an usher in a renaissance or a new rebirth of a new civilization.
I mean, that might be kind of grandiose. One can hope, but there is one certain thing that we suffer from these days, I think, which is this just wave after wave of pessimism that's actually completely out of keeping with the reality of our nature. Number
I think
one.
It's unique. I think it's sad, but I think the pessimism today is, I mean, there have obviously been major problems in American history, but I think the pessimism must be pretty unique to today.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just saturating everything. I mean, to my eye, and I lived in China for a couple of years, and I saw the lamentable wages of what was done in the 60s and 70s and sort of percolate in the minds of and the culture in a way that I don't think was ever true about Chinese culture before today. And you can see the same sort of subversive agenda at work on our culture also. And I think that pessimism is part of it. So I think it's actually much more easily disseminated today than it ever was before. And it's also, let's say, we have a unique situation, I think, in that, the West has always been so extremely tolerant, really. And we have welcomed so many different kinds of people that this can be used against us in a way that I don't think many cultures before have had that particular kind of vulnerability. Anyway, and when we're looking, we're on the brink of an age which is actually completely unimaginable. And those of us in the Bitcoin world and who spend time on artificial intelligence, it's the labor market and the capital markets are about to be re-engineered. And this is going to come along with the re-engineering of the energy systems around the world. And then we have the capacity to develop rapid biotechnology, and nuclear is opening up once more. And then, rocketry and space travel is becoming something popularly discussed. I mean, I think it was just yesterday, the first private spacewalk. So there is this enormous reason for optimism, and there's this enormous reason to cherish the spirit of Prometheus as it moves through Western history, and yet it's being denigrated. And so, I think the reason to have something monumental and large right in the middle of this beautiful harbor is for all of us to look at it and not be able to mistake what precisely we're supposed to be doing here, and also what precisely the American covenant really is. So, I'd like to talk about how the Prometheus figure really is the fundamental archetypal figure of the West and of America. And I think we can go down the rabbit hole as much as you like, but I think, just for starters, we have this covenant in our country, which is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we know we have a statue of liberty there, and liberty meaning manumission and the triumph of ending the slave trade, ending slavery in the West. And that life is sacred. But the pursuit of happiness has always been a little bit less well understood. And I think that that's actually really the point, that there's a sense in which Prometheus is really the pursuit of
Oh, so the
happiness.
Statue of Liberty represents liberty, and Prometheus would sort of honor the pursuit of happiness as well.
Exactly. I think that's a way that the American palate might experience it. And there's some wonderful things about it that make it actually very common to us, even though it's this ancient myth that we don't get a lot of exposure to. And that is to say that, you know, there's this basket of things that we call freedom. The liberating power of technology, the pursuit of things which are meaningful and beautiful and sacred, the elevation of the ideal in our lives, the ennobling of ourselves and our communities through works of perseverance and exhausting ourselves into an art, or into a company or into a technology. I think these things are, broadly speaking, called freedom. And it's an older kind of Germanic term. And it's, so I think the founders were actually drawing on this term freedom as being different from the Roman sense of manumission, you know, freedom from being owned by the state. And so there's a deeper and more powerful, I'd say the pursuit of happiness is the most powerful of the three. Because when you're pursuing freedom, when you're pursuing the ideal, when you're pursuing the most noble work you can conceive of, you're willing to undergo any kind of ordeal to do it. And this is what part of what the Promethean mythos teaches us about Prometheus fashioning man and depriving Zeus of a race of slaves because he put agency and technology and creative will in the kind of Nietzschean sense into man and deprived Zeus of a race of slaves. And so he was tortured. He had to go through this ordeal of, you know, being chained to the rock and having the liver pecked out by the eagle, which of course, you know, Zeus, by the way, Zeus was always, his sort of totem is the eagle because he's like a sky god. And so the Eurasians see these eagles that are pretty fearsome things and they're soaring up there in the sky. They sort of represent Zeus. They also represent the state, by the way. They represent fatalism and they represent the state. And that man's agency is in combat with those forces by nature. It's kind of a primordial law. And so, so the pursuit of happiness is the kind of, and I, as far as I'm concerned, sort of almost plain spoken, politically correct way of saying, freedom, in, you know, 1770s colonial America. And so, I think that this is what they meant all along. And, it kind of grew. I think pursuit of happiness kind of grew as the United States expanded into the continent, to come to mean another term, which is called manifest destiny. And it was
also symbolic because the Pacific Ocean was the end of manifest destiny.
Yes, indeed. And that's really a point of poetic beauty, actually, for our country in that, manifest destiny was also used as a kind of political slogan for taking over the Philippines, and that sort of thing. But I think that actually really coming to the end of the continent and pushing to the fullest extent of where we can maneuver to, that San Francisco was always that beacon. So San Francisco has always been kind of the manifest destiny city. So it couldn't be really more appropriate.
So yeah, it's a bookend to the Statue of Liberty, an oracle to the American people, an icon to a future renaissance. But so basically, like with the Statue of Liberty, how it complements that is the proposal, it would actually be even larger than the Statue of Liberty, or much larger.
Yeah, I think, the proposal is that it's 350 feet, and the hill, that the highest hill point on the island, is about 65 feet up off of sea level already. So it potentially can tower and be extremely powerful. There's something of a poetic, I'm sorry, a sculpture proportionality that is at work, however, too. And anybody who's been to New York Harbor can see the extremely elegant proportions of the Statue of Liberty. It's actually really quite small, but the amphitheater of the harbor and the buildings around create a sort of a specific size that you need for something like that. Not only that, but the pedestal on the Statue of Liberty is about half its height. So it's actually quite small, and yet sort of in like a beautiful spindle is right there in the middle of everything. San Francisco Bay is a little different. It's larger, and it's also more geologically powerful. It's less sedated, I mean, the Hudson is is kind of a slow, meandering thing, and it's, well, I guess it's pretty straight, but it has the feeling of being slow. Whereas the tides and the mountainsides and the fog and the sort of rapidly changing climate of San Francisco has this kind of tumult about it. And also, it being larger requires a larger statue. So, it sits about a mile and a half off of the shore. Now, the Statue of Liberty is about that distance away from Battery Park. This is a similar distance. However, what the city of San Francisco, the downtown area, is obviously set back a little ways. And there's this sort of quite tower area, which is shorter buildings and so on. And so there's a little bit of it calls for something that requires your attention a little more. And then, of course, the size of the Golden Gate is also a big factor,
So
and
it would
that
actually
counts.
be, would it be taller than the Golden Gate Bridge?
Oh no. No. No, the Golden Gate is about 230 meters. It's about 650 feet. So it's the statue would be about half as high. The goal is to have the statue with its eye level look over the plain of the Golden Gate. So, then this, by the way, is pending engineering. We don't think it's going to be, that'll be actually too controversial, structurally speaking, but there's always room for revisiting that. And so I think that, there's another inside note too, which is that, go big or go home. I think that the thing that what really is required is maybe a slightly smaller height would still work within the framing of the bay itself. But this is a monumental thing, and it belongs to all of us. And it needs to usher in, as you've said a couple of times, a kind of rebirth of thinking about the size of things that the American people should be undertaking, the scope and the magnitude and the mass, the weight and the importance of those things. And by the way, maybe the most deeply, that the ideals represented by Prometheus are loud and undeniable and unignorable. So the statue of the monument needs to represent all of those things.
I think with San Francisco, the significance of that is important because it is one of the most beautiful cities in the world and probably the most beautiful city in America, but there is like a lot with the natural beauty and the architectural beauty as well, and a Prometheus quality to some of the landmarks, but there is so much negativity about it. I think it is kind of like polarized in the culture wars where people who are more conservative associate with the left, and there's a lot of the negative news about the decay and the homeless crisis and a lot of negativity in the media about San Francisco. So it's also a revitalization and renaissance. Specifically, I think, well, San Francisco is important, but it's a renaissance for California too.
No question. And that's something that's very dear to my heart and of the rest of us. And there's a sense, for starters, that if San Francisco doesn't work, then America itself doesn't work. Because San Francisco has always been the spear point of experimentation and pioneering of all kinds. And so to see it so beleaguered by this kind of inebriation, of both ideological inebriation, I think, and of course the narcotics, really has the potential to put the lie on our entire American experience. If we can't get it right, then we can't go anywhere else and get it right. And so there's, you know, a very profound part of the Prometheus mythos, which is that and this is not just this particular part, but this is the most iconic, that as Prometheus is chained there to the mountainside, being tortured for giving man technology and fire agency for, you know, 1,000 years, he's devoured, and then he regrows, he regenerates, speaking to the inexhaustible creativity and fundamental regenerative power of man. And so there's something, and you know, that regenerative power, in my estimation, follows a kind of innate capacity for man to idealize and to follow beauty even through the darkest situations. And so, and this, by the way, this is the thing that gives us composure to forge ahead and to triumph the way that our species has. And so our goal is to make this symbol a symbol of idealization of how this fundamentally regenerative power of man can always rise and populate the popular consciousness, and that it in this is a kind of a syrupy term, and I don't really mean it, but there's a sense in which ideals give us an ability, let's say a hope, but an ability to live for a future that is more positive, more abundant, more optimistic. And you know, the San Francisco has basically been the front line of the narcotics war against the United States. It's something that, you know, for starters, people in the Orient want U.S. dollars. So they just want to, you know, harvest as many U.S. dollars from our country as they can. And drugs are a great way to do that. But also, they want to weaken our social bond, and they want to destroy our morale. And so they know that using this weapon, right, especially in the heart of this profoundly powerful city, is you know, could damage our culture very much. So there's a sense that this monument is a rebuffing of that effort to dismantle our ways, and that we are also humane, and that we care about our fellow Americans, and we want regeneration and zeal and optimism and beauty to live and thrive within.
The symbolism between Prometheus and what the prison symbolizes, that contrast is important. But would the statue be built on top or next to the prison, or would the prison be demolished completely? And what would you say to people who say that the prison has any like historic preservation value?
Sure. No, I argue that it does not have any historical preservation value. I know that some folks feel that way. But look, the prison, for starters, well, to answer your first question, that it would be demolished, and that it's its bones, you know, the rubble, the stonework can be reused in the new building, in the platform and the museum, which will sit at the base around the base of the island. The penitentiary, you know, it gets like 2 million visitors a year. There's a lot of people that go in there. But I contend, and having been there, and I think lots of people will have the same experience, that there's not very much that's particularly moving or culturally enriching about it. And that it actually it kind of resonates like a sort of a sideshow. You know, like if you are watching a football game and then the commercials come on, you have to watch the commercials also. And so if you travel to San Francisco as a tourist, you might go to Alcatraz also. But it doesn't, I don't think, have a great deal of cultural significance. And on in contrast, I think it represents a prison of failed ideologies and the prison of what happens to the soul and the mind in when it's trapped by narcotics. So no, you know, it was only operational for about 30 years. They only built it because they thought it would be, you know, sort of away from the city. And they didn't quite have the same zeal for, I think, city beautification as we should have today. So, and you know, it also, I don't know what your audience thinks, but I think that it looks a bit like a, you know, a Romanian Soviet style prison camp. You know, it's the kind of, it's like a New Deal project. It was sort of that era. But
I think like architecturally, you had like Art Deco in the during the boom of the 20s that was more grandiose, and then I think I don't know if you would call it like streamlined modern, but Art Deco was followed by more like utilitarian architectural aesthetic.
certainly. I mean, yeah, that was a product, I think, of Weimar, you know, the Weimar architectural sort of disinheriting of, you know, cultural tradition that happened in Germany made its way architecturally around the world really, really quickly. So I think that certainly happened. But the prison itself, you know, they had some noteworthy prisoners. I think it's more of a macabre kind of curiosity than it really is anything meaningful to anybody. And juxtaposed to, you know, this monument and a museum of breakthrough technology and pioneering and entrepreneurship to surround the bottom of the island, will be, I think, an order of magnitude, if not more resonant and powerful and meaningful to all tourists, all comers, and to the United States. And I think also, incidentally, lead it to be a much more powerful commercial success as well.
Can you give some background on the design? Would you have interest in different aesthetics ranging from Art Deco to neoclassical? And would you put the design up to a vote, or do you think it's more aristocratic to have the artist decide on the design?
Yeah, I
And
think that's a
you're the
nice way to
artist
put
behind,
it.
are you the artist behind it?
No, I'm not, and I think that's important. And you know, I would ask your audience if anyone knows who the designer of the Statue of Liberty was. Most people don't know, and that's
I
wonderful.
know, so like I know he was French, but I can't name his name off the top of my head.
Yeah, I mean, he in the true spirit of a sculptor, he was French, but he didn't want his name associated with it because he thought it would take away from the magnitude and the power of the art. And I think he's right, or he was right, that so as far as I'm concerned, no. I mean, I have, you know, lots of ways that I want it to be, but I'm not going to impose those on the process.
Is it, would you say it's more neoclassical or Art Deco?
Yeah, it's actually that's sort of an unknown. My inclinations are that it's somewhere in between that has motifs of both, because I think that actually both of those speak to the sort of progressive will that Americans have kind of uniquely with our roots in a neoclassical heritage, but also a sort of futuristic dynamo of Art Deco that it speaks to another Promethean artifact that we can talk about maybe in a minute, but called archaeofuturism, which is not actually as well defined as one might want. And we're in the driver's seat to help crystallize what that means. But no,
retrofuturism is sort of like the future we should have had, like an optimistic, like taking the best from the past, but not being too reactionary about or being stuck in the past, but using borrowing from the past to create a more optimistic or exciting vision for the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that I think about archaeofuturism is that it, and I'm actually not a scholar about this or anything, but the way
there's
I feel
a book, there's a book by Guillaume Fay called Archaeofuturism, but I haven't, to be honest, I haven't actually read it.
Right. Right. Well, and I think that there's a sort of American spin on it too. That the things that are archaic, I think he refers to mostly are that they are, more of a aristocratic structuring of the social order. In my view, the archaic actually is more resonant with what I described earlier about the pursuit of happiness being this primordial instinct around which the mankind is formed. And it's as ancient and as kind of pre-verbal as it can be. And almost to the point where when we sense it in ourselves, it feels very old. And yet it is the instinct for originality. It's the instinct for newness, for uncovering the truth behind
even Golden Gate Bridge, you could say, is like archaeofuturist, or the, what's it called, Palace of Fine Arts, Koi Tower, like a lot of San Francisco landmarks already sort of have that. Even the Transamerica Pyramid.
Yeah, that's true. There's that aspect of futurism. I mean, Koi Tower has kind of an Art Deco motif, obviously, and I'm not convinced that the Palace of Fine Arts does actually because it was, it's built with the World's Fair quite a bit earlier. But then putting them all together, you're right. There's a bit of a thread there. No, but this instinct for futurism, of course, is what the San Francisco Bay embodies. So, among all the places of the world, right? So, so our sculptor, his name is Fenn de Villiers, and he's a wonderful philosopher of sculpture and also a totally beautiful artist. And we've asked him to create something that is forward moving and uplifting and vital and resonant with both neoclassical forms and also Art Deco motifs and modernistic motifs. And I think that he will do an absolutely wonderful job. And, it will be a somewhat of a different form. It will be more movement than most people, I think, are used to seeing in these large statues across the world, which to my eye all look, well, many of them look like sort of like potatoes, they're like sitting there still and without a lot of gesticulation. And unfortunately, some of the larger statues around the world, which do attempt sort of dynamic motion, end up looking, in my estimation, a bit oversaturated with it and a little bit too, well, frankly, I think sometimes they look a bit like on the cartoon side. But in any event, because of the sort of layering of these different motifs and a lack of concise, precise definition that could make it quite kitschy, these one will see the sort of elemental forms and the suggestion of these each one of these motifs in a way that I think is going to end up being extremely elegant.
It may sound unpractical or grandiose, but the plan basically it's hedging that if Trump wins, it's to appeal to Trump as the president has authority over national parks.
Yeah, President Biden just, I think it was maybe 3 or 4 months ago, put about 120,000 acres just outside of Los Angeles that was a national forest into a national monument so that it couldn't be used for development. The Grand Canyon was created in this way. The Statue of Liberty was also created in this way as national monuments. Alcatraz is a national park. And so it's federal lands, and it can be fashioned into a national monument under the Antiquities Act by the president. Now, my view is that President Trump, in the middle of 2020, when all the statues were coming down, he signed an executive order to create a national sculpture memorial garden. And that was one of the first things that Biden rescinded when he got the office. So it's natural to presume that these symbols of heroism and nobility and optimism might not be so friendly to, a Harris administration.
Would you continue pursuing the project if Kamala Harris is elected, or is this totally
No, of
hedging on a
course.
Trump victory?
No. No, of course we will. It may be that she wouldn't approve it, though. So if that's the case, then we can wait until the next administration. Because the location is so utterly important, and the monument itself is so utterly important to our national spirit that look, the Statue of Liberty took 20 years, 30 years. I don't think it took quite 30 years. But, they conceived of it and started working on it in 1882, I think. And then it wasn't installed until 1907, I believe. So anyway, it was quite a long time. Something of this nature could very well take a long time as well. And that's all right. There's no reason not to keep going. It's I think kind of obvious, though, that after President Trump already made his executive order, and he's a real estate guy, and so he kind of understands the importance of monuments like this already. And I'll tell you one other thing, that the symbol of regeneration, which the statue emblemizes, is actually not just very sort of poetically resonant with the Statue of Liberty in New York, but it's also resonant with Trump Tower, because Trump Tower
Yeah,
was
Trump Tower is very retrofuturistic, especially like the 80s variation of that.
Yeah, that's true. And people might remember, although it's been a while, that New York City in the 70s and early 80s was pretty rough. And then Giuliani came in famously and kind of turned things around. And Donald Trump was a big part of that, of building buildings and developing his properties in where he could get, I think, good deals around town. And I think Trump Tower was one of those. So there's a sense in which there's this kind of regeneration thing going on between Trump Tower and the Alcatraz Monument, the Prometheus Monument. So it makes sense that he
And
would
Trump
be
also
more
said something
familiar.
about wanting to build more like neoclassical architecture for public works projects.
That's right. Yeah. I want to touch on the neoclassicism a little bit, but certainly for government buildings, there was I can't remember if it was an executive order or a commission or both, but that was yet another thing that was rescinded by Biden when he came in, is building all new public buildings in a neoclassical style. There is a sense, however, in my opinion, that neoclassicism represents a kind of traditionalism that has not been as successful as we want it to be
Like,
in
if
the
you take
form of our
Washington,
institution.
D.C., I think the problem that I have with Washington, D.C., it's almost like it's not, it could have been more grandiose in a archaeo-futurist direction. but it almost could be a bit too much like low key, where it feels a bit too much like a cemetery.
Yeah, it's true. It's there. Well, neoclassicism has, I think, as central to its design, stillness and the staidness of institutions, the quietude of these things. And Prometheus is obviously not that at all. Prometheus is the opposite. He's forward moving, uplifting, and vital. He's dynamic. He also symbolizes bucking the regime. And so, there's a sense in which a purely neoclassical statue for this monument would not fit, would not work, and that's okay because that doesn't represent all that there is to America, right? I mean, even to be honest, the Statue of Liberty has this kind of clever aspect to it, which is that you don't really know if it's a man or a woman. There's a sense in which there's this like dynamic churning underneath that liberty represents that isn't the kind of or that you experience when you see the statue that is that liberty doesn't actually represent the staid institutionalism either. And so I think that for people who are patriotic and who love neoclassical architecture, there will be plenty to love about this monument. However, it's just not the entire story of us. And so we have to endeavor to make it a story about the optimistic and beautiful future as well.
Do you think this is important symbolically? You touched on this, but countering sort of the iconoclasm of tearing down statues and what happened in 2020, and how if you tear something down from the past, you have an obligation to create something better, but that obviously didn't happen. It's about,
Right.
it's sort of a, it's a counterbalance to like that spirit of like destruction.
Yeah, I think there's just pure deconstructionism involved in those teardowns. And that was the thing that really stoked my ire. And why 2020 for me was the sort of one of the times that one would endeavor to launch something like this. And like I mentioned earlier, I spent a lot of time studying China and immersed in Chinese history. And one of the things that they did in China in the 60s was they tore down the four olds, right? The old aspects of religion and culture and family and institutions around China, which were the things that gave a kind of coherence to Chinese life. The sort of Maoist thing about tearing down statues, and which, by the way, also happened in the Bolshevik Revolution, tearing down churches and so on, that this is understood to be a way of subverting the courage of a people. And so it certainly is our monument is certainly a let's say a fist in the face of that attitude. And the wonderful thing about being out there on the island like this is that if you want to tear it down, you're going to have to go swim with the sharks.
Should artists have a greater role in the economy? And do you think the arts complements technological innovation or tech part as
Oh,
part of
gosh.
techne?
Gosh, no, not anymore. They absolutely should. I mean, the entirety of the spirit of the Renaissance, which I think was a beautiful Promethean event in Western history, which, by the way, I consider the American Revolution to be the apex of the Renaissance. But the Renaissance was this outgrowth of the unification, the idea that there was a unity between art and beauty making and technology and the study of nature. And, the study of sort of God's laws in a new, fresh, and naturalistic way, as opposed to a staid and sort of fatalistic totalitarian way, like the church had sort of run it up until then. And No, I don't think we have this at all. I'm hoping that down deep in the hearts of people who see this monument, that they will something will stir them in a way to bring forward a kind of naturalistic sense of beauty, even if they're engineers, right? Even if they're very technical people. And that multidisciplinary approach to life is actually the way that we should be. That surely should be the governing aspect of
Yeah,
our
because ideally they should complement
psyche.
each other, but like one complaint is that about like Silicon Valley is that a lot of the people in tech are pushing out the creative types, which is kind of, there's a lot of different angles to that, but it's kind of sad because ideally technological innovation and cultural or aesthetic innovation should complement each other.
Yeah, I think that's really true. Well, you know, the more sound money is needed in that equation, the more large technology companies become sort of dependent on the excuse me, fiat sort of system, and the more they become kind of monolithic. And so there's a movement which is, you know, big tech versus little tech. And you know, little tech is the creative, destruction-oriented, and dynamic upstart kind of part of the economy there. And then there are the large technology giants, which are, you know, incredibly powerful and sort of state-oriented now, and maybe not nearly as creative. I mean, you know, for example, Peter Thiel, I remember, castigated Google for owning huge amounts of treasury bonds because they couldn't think of what else to do with it. So, you know, there's certainly plenty of that going on, and I think that furthermore, this multidisciplinary way of thinking about the world has at its roots a kind of it's as though your own individuation and your own self-sovereignty are kind of the driving force. And of course, Prometheus is a he's the titan of those forces, of those spirits, and of self-sovereignty and self-individuation and a greater sense of what Nietzsche called downgoing, you know, exhausting yourself into your art so that you can bring forward something more powerful in you and more ideal and you know, more productive and transformative in your work. So one hopes that this monument will spur that spirit in people who come to see it and will remind them that that is their destiny, because I don't think anything could really be more profound and will have a more profound effect on our culture and our civic life.
So yeah, like with the Silicon Valley, it has like this history of the spirit of innovation, but there's also a more negative side of Silicon Valley where it's becoming more like a state bureaucracy, and the whole thing about repression of free speech and what Silicon Valley should ideally be and what it is now. And you also have a proposal for a seastead off the coast of SF as a rule for kind of a new Silicon Valley.
Yeah, it's true. I actually think that there's a you know, one could say that the first technology and the most profound technology of man is speech, not fire, but speech. I don't know which one came first, but you know, speech allows you to differentiate yourself and to organize with great numbers of people and, you know, satisfy the wants in like an economic sense of a larger and larger array of different types of people. And that's part of what has made man so economically powerful and triumphant, you know, taking resources from the other beasts and metabolizing, like, you know, like the Highlander, you know, where there can be only one, where, you know, mankind has been more powerful in doing this than any of the other species because of speech. And you know, at least half of our brain is dedicated to social interactions. So the idea that we would censor speech right from the heart of where free speech technologies should emanate, is sacrilegious, to say the least. And so I think that you know, Prometheus stands against this in every way, and it should be a reminder to all of those who drive their, you know, Porsches up the Highway 1 to their fancy houses in San Rafael, that it's a warning.
And do you want to comment on the Seastead proposal?
Well, I don't know very much about it. I know some of the people.
So this isn't your proposal. This is someone else's.
No. We don't have a Seastead proposal. No, but there once was there were I think several, but there once was one I think with Seasteading Institute, which was to set up an oil derrick across out I think maybe offshore
in international waters.
Yeah, and have that be a place with its own laws and a way to experiment with its own policies and governance system. And then there was another proposed to have people work on or live on cruise ships and then disembark to come in and work in Silicon Valley during the day and go back at night, so as not to flout just not to go afoul of the immigration laws, but still be able to work in Silicon Valley. So, but that I think was maybe 10 years ago. Both of them were longer than 10 years ago. No, but the one thing that I think is important to sort of along those lines to talk about is the museum that is in a way aiming to be a kind of temple to the Promethean spirit that encircles the island at the foot of the monument. Because the story that people gain awareness of when they visit this museum, which will be about, you know, rocketry and agriculture and biotechnology and sound money and you name it, will showcase in a way that isn't really done anywhere else, to my knowledge, the unbelievable amount of difficulty that inventors and pioneers have gone through in history, the kind of endurance and perseverance and clearness of vision, clarity of vision, that they've needed to triumph, to make their vision into reality so that we can have the benefits, remaining, right? And that we can sort of grow at a compounding rate, because of their, ingeniousness and initiative and industriousness. So the around the base of the island there, you know, it's also, it's quite high actually. It comes off of the water about 20 feet, and it presents this very beautiful opportunity to both look back onto the city and look out into the ocean through the Golden Gate, and also sort of become immersed in the mythos of Prometheus as it has been alive through our culture. And I think that most people, A, won't know very much about the Prometheus story when the monument is first built. I mean, that's a part of our job, is to make sure that we raise the public awareness about it. But still, there won't be people. So when they visit the island, they'll be able to see in a very visceral way, with historical examples, that are our ancestors who created wonderful things that we all maybe even take for granted, but which were, you know, leaps forward in human well-being. And so there is this sense that we're being subverted and ground down all the time, and yet there's this indefatigable, permanent kind of optimistic will that has always been at work. And so reminding people of that spirit, I think, is an equally profound part of the monument, because reconnecting with the pursuit of happiness, with individualization and self-sovereignty, and this call to be industrious, This will give permission and confidence in a way that's interactive and augmented reality and so on. And, you know, as you might imagine, if you can envision looking across the bay at the monument and seeing something distracting on the base of the island, our endeavor is to actually conceal it such that it's actually going to be parts of it, at least, will be quite hard to see, and yet still let in light and still let in the sort of the optimism from the sun that comes down. And then, of course, also showing vignettes of parts of the monument.
So we'll be made of metal, so the sun hitting it will have a dramatic impact. We made of brass.
Yeah, there'll be this native plants covering parts of it. And then, you know, as you can imagine, there's a sort of strategic way of letting light in where you can create a huge amount of space internally and yet keep it from being too distracting and too visible to observers on the shore. So there's going to be, I think, an extremely elegant balance between those two things as well. And it's going to kind of rhyme with the dynamism of the statue. And we have an amazing architect to design that for us as well, who's done some projects around the world, quite well known, some projects around the world that already have these elements to them. So we're extremely lucky in this regard.
Yeah, it sounds very exciting. And if you want to, is there anything else you'd like to add about the project that we didn't touch upon? And do you want to plug the website or anything else?
Sure, yeah, thanks.
With the project?
Yeah, you bet. Well, please come to see AmericanColossus.org. And there's a Substack, AmericanColossus.substack.com. And we're going to be releasing some live media here in the next 6 weeks or so, which will start giving people a sort of a sense for the mythos, the story of Prometheus, and how it interweaves with the story of us as Americans and what it means philosophically and artistically. And we're very excited to have begun a film project, which will be a docuseries that'll trace the making of the monument. And then also in the same fashion, weave in parts of the mythology and parts of history, of course, also contemporary events and so on. So that'll be out in starting 90 days or so from now, middle of December. And just urge everybody to stay tuned and please come check us out and send us a message if you'd like to be involved.
Ross Calvin, great show. Thank you so much for being on.
Great, Robert. I really appreciate it. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you for tuning in. You can follow Robert Stark on his Substack at robertstark.substack or on his website at starktruthradio.com. See you next time.